Good afternoon and welcome to Reality Check Radio. You are with Media Matters with Eminem, Marie and Marty. Marty Gibson, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I've had a week.
Yeah.
I've had a bit of a week. This time last week, I was in court with my dearly beloved, with Mr. Marie. Yes, eagle-eyed people over the weekend may have seen on social media around a New Zealand Napier doctor that had been in court. Well, that was Mr. Marie, and I can now talk about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is this you coming out of the closet show?
I know. I'm coming out. I feel a Dollar Summer song coming on. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, well, it's been hard not talking about it because it's such a manifestation of so many of the things we're talking about, and it's obviously deeply affected the life of your family. And there's something about getting caught in the grinding wheels of government when you're inconvenient to them that's it's humbling, and maybe isn't the word, because humbling is healthy. It does make you feel small, though, doesn't it? Being a pawn.
It's the lack of absolute control that you have with the machine, and that there are so many others out there that hold so much sway over the outcome of your health, well-being, and well-being that is really disconcerting.
Yeah, I guess that's it, isn't it? It's feeling that people who may be slightly malevolent are holding sway over your destiny and the health and happiness of your family and your financial, your ability to earn a living.
Yeah. First up, it's around, okay, so this has been going on. Would you believe, you know, this whole saga has been going on. It really did start 3 years next week. The legal process has been going just on two. Now, we're just going to touch on it in terms of the loose themes of things today, how that ties into the wider sort of zeitgeist of what's going on here in New Zealand and elsewhere. We are going to be doing an in-depth interview with Alistair Harding, so do watch out for that. That is coming. We just want to get the sentencing in first, which hasn't arrived yet. I would have hoped by today it would have arrived, but not quite yet. The thing that I do want to say is, first up, you know, we do a lot of brickbats on this show, but every now and then I'd like to put a bouquet out where it's due in regards to the media, and that goes out to Rick Stevens from NZMe, who has been the one journalist that sort of has followed this all the way through. He's been at court most of the hearings that we've been at, and he's been the one that has most accurately reported this all the way through, unlike one of his compatriots from Stuff, which was less than accurate in his reporting in the early stages, and that inaccuracy allowed us to get name suppression, which is part of the reason why I haven't been able to talk about it, is because of that suppression, partially due to the grossly appalling reporting that went on by them. However, Rick does not fall into this camp, and the article, which was published in the New Zealand Herald, it was front page, which we didn't realise until late Saturday night, but front page here of our local Hawke's Bay Today, and also News Talk ZB released it on Facebook. The headline is, "An Ethical Dilemma, 30-Year Medical Career Ended by COVID Vaccine Stance." And straight away, I was stunned by that, Marty, because for the first time in I don't know how long, we didn't have a headline. And contrast that actually to the headline that Sue Gray got in the newspapers. Hers was, it had those fatal words, anti-vax, in it. I was fully expecting anti-vax doctor, you know, insert rest of headline here. That didn't happen. And Rick's article, if no one has seen it, he will haven't caught up with it yet, is a pretty accurate finding.
Yeah, no, it was balanced and is what you'd hope for.
It was decidedly old school. So, Rick, thank you for that. We do appreciate that. In a quick nutshell, the Cliff Notes version of this, and as I said, we'll go into detail with Alistair, the Cliff Notes version of this is my husband was like many out there in the medical fraternity who were faced literally with a Clayton's choice. And your choice was you had to follow the dictates of Health New Zealand, and essentially you were put in an ethical dilemma of choosing between your Hippocratic Oath and your obligations of a doctor to do no harm, and actually having autonomy to exercise your profession you know, with the 13 years worth of training that you've had, I might add, in my husband's case, to practice medicine, or you listen to the government, which inserted itself between the doctor-patient relationship and told you that you now no longer have no rights in regards to your own bodily autonomy. That's been taken away from you. If you want to continue to work, you need to get the jabs. And so, you know, I'm not going to go into the contention of the mandates. I think that we're all pretty on page and on board on with that. So what we then did is we looked for alternatives, because my husband's the only ophthalmologist in Napier. At the time, there were two others in Hastings. They were massively swamped in capacity. This is a provincial area. Mm. You know, we're under-resourced. So how do we continue to keep eye services going to our patients? The problem that we had is we also had a medical council who ostensibly were wanting to, they were hunting. They had become the black uniformed Gestapo of the medical world in this country. We're going to talk a little bit more about an article later on the media have just absolutely blindingly ignored. So we looked at going to an alternative medical council that was working under Tikanga. Now, Tikanga's popped up in the news this week as well around, you know, the guidance. So there's a lot of elements that were in our case that symptoms and outcomes of what's currently going on in our society today. And I have to say, we were found guilty. We had the hearing that we had was sentencing. We have asked for a discharge, but our lawyer has argued for that and argued brilliantly. Thank you, David Jones, QC, and Mary Nelson, LLB. You guys have been incredible walking alongside us every step of this journey. And it was hopeful. It was hopeful to actually stand in the courtroom and be in front of a judge that actually got the dilemma. It took him a wee while to get there, but he got there.
Mm. And it's incredibly difficult to get into ophthalmology, isn't it? You're operating on people's eyes. As you said, it's a very in-demand field, and there aren't enough, and there's huge waiting lists. So it begs the question, well, if you don't give an exemption to someone who's doing that, where did the 11,000 exemptions in New Zealand go?
Well, according to Brian the Bot, who was, interestingly enough, the one media outlet on Facebook that allowed commenting to continue was on Newstalk ZB.
Mm.
It was overwhelmingly positive, but there were a couple of people in there, not so much. One of them was someone who was called Brian. Brian was very busy. After about day 2.5, and Brian pretty much hadn't drawn breath when had a cup of tea or a lie down that entire time, I figured that Brian was definitely a dummy account being probably operated by multiple people, if not AI generated. And according to Brian, those exemptions, because that got brought up multiple times, those exemptions were placed there in order to allow crucial staff and continuity of those staff within the healthcare system, i.e. Health New Zealand, or it was at the time, to get vaccinated because they weren't able to do so. So, which then raises the question, so many not yet vaccinated. I wonder why that was, because they were allowed to be vaccinated well ahead of everybody else, you know, like months and months, more than 6 months ahead of everybody else. When you look at those OIAs, there was something like, 300 of senior clinicians, I'm talking now doctors, if you worked within Te Whatu'ora, you were golden. There were 350 odd that got exemptions. Only, I think, was it one or two outside of the VHB or Te Whatu'ora system got exemptions. Now, my husband sat outside, and we knew, because we had other friends and colleagues that applied for exemptions or working outside of the DHB milieu or only contractors at best, every single one of them was rejected. Every single one.
I understood that ACC also, their staff were often exempt because they were getting the phone calls.
Well, ACC. I know somebody who worked ACC, more than a 20-year veteran. The staff were told that they were going to be mandated. This is at a provincial office. This person did not want to get the jab. Put in a series of contingencies to be seconded off to other community-based care entities in order to continue the work that they were doing, which was accident prevention in the community, so then they could subvent the mandate. It's very clever, but it was a pretty, you know, they had to sort of literally, it was quite a Svengali move in order to be able to do that within the legal framework. And right at the 11th hour, they were brought into the office. Everyone else had been vaccinated. They were the only outlier. They were getting ready to set this sort of secondment in motion to move them outside of that. And they got pulled in saying, look, you don't need to do this step. You're no longer under that mandate. And that's because a blanket exemption was sought for everyone in that department.
And this is while Ashley Bloomfield was denying people exemptions who had suffered very nasty anaphylaxis with their first vaccine, and then was telling them, well, get your second one in a hospital where you've got a resus unit. So if you die, we can bring you back to life.
Yep.
Incredible.
Yeah. So that's where we're at right now is... We are hopefully by the end of this week, hopefully by tomorrow, we will have that judgment. And we've been indicated that we will. Because my husband's pivoted. I have talked about the pivot. He's studying full time, has been studying full time for 2 years. We just want to keep moving forward because you can't stay still. I think I had this wonderful conversation, I don't know whether you caught it, with an Australian GP called Gareth Cock. Now, over there, he's still within the Australian Medical Council system. He's been deregistered. 5 years they've been dragging his case out for, 5 years. Mm. But he hasn't been able to work as a GP. So he's funnily enough, working in IT and doing some additional studies in IT as well, similar to my husband. So he's sort of gone down that pathway too. The one big difference with us versus many of the others that you saw is because we saw those exemptions weren't being going out. And also too, we saw what was going on within the medical council, which brings me to the centrist article, October 8th, which of course came out a few days or day before our hearing, 2 days before our hearing. And this is exclusive insider reveals New Zealand Medical Council's hardball tactics during COVID. NZDSOS, and I know Paul has spoken to the team there, took a case against the New Zealand Medical Council, essentially stating that they were acting beyond their mandate in terms of what they were doing, and they had a hearing around this. This article covers some of the statements that were in court by a whistleblower, a former member of the New Zealand Medical Council. This is absolutely damning at the attitude displayed by the New Zealand Medical Council at that time. And crickets.
Yeah, no, it really wasn't reported. One of the most damning things I felt one of the most cynical moves that bordered on absolute malevolence was there was about a 3-week gap between doctors being issued with basically a threat from the medical council. If you say anything that contradicts Ministry of Health advice, if you say anything that could be construed as anti the experimental gene therapy, you will lose your practicing certificate. We will suspend your ability to earn a living. And about 2 or 3 weeks after that, you had Dear Leader on television saying, actually, you should talk to your GP because they're the people who know you best. And so they'll be in a position to offer you the best advice. And we've just threatened them losing their ability to earn a living if they say something that we don't want them to say. So I think they're going to give the advice we want. Sort of paraphrasing that, I think people are going to get a test, otherwise we're going to keep them in our facilities. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing with doctors is that another way you vary from other doctors' relationships is there are a lot of doctors who, when they get out of med school, and it's not going to be a popular thing for me to say, get crash tackled by a lady who's always wanted to marry a doctor. And although they earn a lot of money, many of them, you know, then move into a nice house with a big mortgage and granite bench tops. The kids are at private school. If they stop the train, there's a derailment pretty quickly. One of the criticisms of NZDSOS was that, there's not many of them. you know, a tiny proportion of New Zealand's doctors, and a lot of them are just post-retirement. There's a reason for that. It's because they were the ones with the ticker, like your husband, to stand on his principles and say, no, I'm not going to do that. And one of the most sobering things we've discovered through this dark chapter of New Zealand's history is that the proportion of people who are guided by a moral compass is far smaller than what we would have liked to have thought. And it's far more difficult to stand on your principles when times get tough.
Yeah.
And so you've got to take a tiny proportion of a profession who are standing on principles as pretty serious and representative of far more than their numbers would suggest. Mm. I know plenty of doctors who were privately having some real difficulties with what was going on but didn't say a thing. And I know I noticed a difference between doctors who did have real reservations and the doctors that didn't, were that the doctors that didn't were only consuming material they were getting from the Ministry of Health. Their reasoning was as spurious as, well, the Ministry of Health's never put us crook before. That's certainly what led my father to get his vaccines. You know, they were always, you know, pretty trustworthy.
Yeah, well, and that is the nub. Mm. That is the nub. You know, there is a thing called the chain of trust. And the chain of trust is where you know that in medicine, people that don't understand the whole hierarchy, there is a hierarchy of medicine. It's almost like a military type scenario. And you always have, right from when you're training through to when you practice, that you have to immediately trust and follow the guidance of the person immediately above you in that chain. Those chains were obliterated. They were obliterated in a way of language and pigtail sort of twisting. So, for example, you just mentioned it before. What came out was a guidance statement, a guidance statement, not enforcement, a guidance statement. Here's the thing with a guidance statement. They claim, the medical council, that that wasn't compulsory because it was just a guidance statement. And yet, they stated... Yeah, so this is the circular argument that they give, and this is where the linguistic gymnastics come in. I've talked about these linguistic gymnastics before, right? The medical council state, as regulators, we respect an individual's right to have their own opinions, but it is our view that there is no place for anti-vaccination messages in professional health practice, nor any promotion of anti-vaccination claims, including on social media and advertising by health practitioners. So we respect your rights, but actually, no, we don't respect your rights. And then, as Richard Ashton testified, the complaints handled by the New Zealand Medical Council, the complaints ranged from a doctor emailing a colleague with doubts about the vaccine through to doctors advising some patients, e.g. pregnant women and children, not to take the vaccine, to doctors speaking at public meetings against wholesale vaccination of everybody. It's that horizontal policing. This is what totalitarianism is all about. It's that horizontal policing. And they horizontally policed range from a doctor emailing a colleague. So then who laid the complaint? The colleague? So what is that?
Or a nurse who overheard. And nurses, you know, I mean, I love nurses. They do great work in the hospital. Anyone who's ever had a friend or relative or been in hospital themselves will attest to, you know, how hard they work and what a great service the vast majority of them provide. But in terms of the hierarchy of taking orders, nurses are primarily trained to do what they're told. There's not that they follow procedure. Mm. And so you saw in the COVID a lot of the most ardent enforcers of the groupthink and status quo were nurses, including one of my aunts, who I know for a fact will never be listening to this radio show, but became almost evangelistic in her passion for everyone getting jabbed and would brook no counter-argument whatsoever.
With nursing, I mean, one of the things that happened is they were elevated because of the need for vaccination, that messianic fervor that took hold was, I think, most acutely focused at that nursing cohort.
A lot of them were good at doing the dances and stuff like that, you know, that they were doing in their empty hospitals, which were overrun by COVID patients.
Yeah. But also, too, they were the ones that led that vaccinator force. And, you know, I'm going to hear some bombshells that we'll be dropping with Alistair, but that involves that. And it all went to that social pressure, that horizontal policing. And the nurses, you know, when I speak to nurses, and I know you have too, that fall into this ethical boundary, they had exactly the same problems. I mean, their council was doing exactly the same thing.
The midwives council did some horrible stuff I've been hearing about lately.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a lot of stories that will be told about this time in years to come. And we speak often that it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, and we're talking decades before the full truth comes out of the levels of coercion, the techniques by these nudge units to get people turned around from saying, no, I wouldn't have a mandatory novel vaccine that, you know, is actually not a vaccine, but only called one to relax the requirements around legislation for safety, to getting people to say, yes, yeah, stick it in, you know, another three, sure.
Mm, yeah. One of the things that we learned through all of this was the absolute dogged pursuit by the Ministry of Health to prosecute not only us, but anybody else. And where we differed from these other cases that came in front of the Medical Council is that we sought advice early on looking at tikanga. So tikanga for us, because of, you know, my knowledge of tikanga and other people that we knew, we thought actually this could be a way. I mean, they've spent in the legal process, I mean, we just need to look at the Law Society now having a compulsory paper on tikanga for all LLB students from next year. Mm. They are ramroading.
It was a government that was talking a lot about the importance of treating Māori, Te Ao Māori worldviews with equal respect to Pākehā ones in areas like health.
And so the WHC, the Wakamaringa Health Council, was created in 2021 at that time, looking at all the pillars of tikanga based around Te Ao Māori and Te Mātauranga Māori and health. And they created this body and organisation to be able to practice any form of medicine or alternative treatments under that auspice. And I mean, this isn't just a two-bit, oh yes, you know, this is lip service, we're going to do this. This organisation, they sought advice from Kaumātua. They went to multiple kūti to be able to go and discuss with elders and Māori leaders how this should work, what does tikanga mean to them in this aspect. They went to multiple meetings at Waitangi. They met with leaders in the lower house there. They got pretty much buy-in from all different iwi leaders at the kōtis that they attended. I mean, you and I both looked into, when we looked into this, we attended a hui together as well. So this wasn't just a fly-by-night, five-minute, yes, we're going to slap the label tikanga on it and pop into support and she'll be right.
Yeah, there's some serious medical, intellectual firepower involved as well to maintain safety. And you know, that was the unique thing about your husband's case, was it's very rare for a complaint before the medical council to be a criminal charge, isn't it? That's normally for something that's actually dangerous, like someone practicing without a medical license.
And the reason for that is because it wasn't in front of the medical council. We circumvented the medical council's jurisdiction on this by voluntarily deregistering, because there were some that tried to do that and the medical council held on to them and said, no, this offending happened while you were registered, we're not letting you go,
right.
You know, which is what they did, I think, to Emmanuel Garcia. For us, we saw the writing on the wall. I mean, the witch hunt had started from the moment pretty much the mandates were announced. My husband being my husband, he's some not blessed always with reading a room. He's a very, you know, as not knowing him as well as you do, he's a very singularly focused man.
Yeah.
And so, of course, he saw the ethical dilemma of this, like, as plain as day. And he couldn't understand. He didn't fall into the mass. He wasn't under the spell of the mass formation that went on. So for him, being outside of it, he's so, why are these people, why are you saying this? This is so strange. Surely you'll be asking questions about the side effect profile. Why haven't they got the inserts in the vial? Why don't we get to see this? Why is this contract so secret? I don't understand this. This vaccine only took 9 months. How could it only take 9 months? What did they do testing ahead of time? Why did they change the definition of vaccines?
How can they say it's safe to get to pregnant women? Normally they need at least 10 years of use in the wider population before they let it anywhere near a pregnant woman. And this has been tested on 20 pregnant mice, and it's suddenly safe to get to pregnant women. Yeah, so, all that stuff.
So he voluntarily deregistered from medical council. Now, prior to that deregistration, the wagons were already circling. We had, and this is where nurses come in, we had some nurses that we knew well. One of them we knew exceptionally well. I'm still pulling the knife out of my back on that one.
Again, she was just following the orders.
And that's this is just more than just following the orders. No, broke rules and protocols because the greater good was at stake. So therefore it's amazing how the end can justify the means, Marty.
Yeah.
And in court, when that was tested during the case, that Phil's vaccination status, because unlike the others, he never came out and publicly said anywhere, I'm not vaccinated. I mean, my husband doesn't even have a social media profile, for goodness sake, which the media hated because of
COVID. He does now.
They hated that. The fact that he was an absolute ghost. Me, not so much. But him, yes. And so they hated all of that.
Mm.
And then the wagons were circling and he made
the nail that sticks up gets hammered down.
Exactly. And so by voluntary deregistering, it took the medical council out of the equation because we knew that the medical council had fallen. Nothing in here that Richard Aston testified to surprised me. In fact, I can even hear the chair, who I have got some really tasty words that I could use, but I won't because I promised the girls that I monitor my language. I know the restraint, but I can literally hear him saying at a meeting, and this is what he would say, the culture change was unreal. The chair would introduce these COVID items with, here we go, it's flat earth time, get your tinfoil hats on, we've got another anti-vaxxer in front of us, or the vitamin C brigade has arrived. The majority of the council went along with the missive and ridiculing approach, with maybe three people, including myself, not joining in the prejudgment game.
Mm.
That's what you were having to deal with. We knew that that's what you were, that was being the attitude that was going on there. So by circumventing them, it forced the Ministry of Health to actually come for us. And our case was the first of its kind ever to appear in the courts because of that.
Yeah, I think there's a bit to run on what the medical council actually is as well. It's not a group of doctors necessarily in New Zealand looking at the best standard of care. That originates from an international organisation whose links with the pharmaceutical industry are pretty strong. And there are a lot of those sort of things that weren't as they appear. Yeah, so now we've got the news report, I think it was on One News the other morning, Tauranga District Council have voted to fluoridate their water. And then in the next breath they're saying, they were scared of getting fined personally by the government. So is this veneer of democracy, but it's because they've been heavied into mass medicating their population. Now, I don't pretend to be an expert on fluoridation, but I'll tell you what, my level of trust to give public health authorities the benefit of the doubt is zero. My willingness to receive ridicule and et cetera as an argument against someone doing that is zero. If the process is rotten and it needs fixing before I'll take any more arbitrary decisions like that and not scrutinize them for malfeasance.
Trust, you're so right. Gosh. And people, you know, everyday Kiwis, even the everyday Kiwis that went to the go-alongs to get-alongs, and let's face it, that's most Kiwis. You know, they've got families to feed, they've got mortgages to pay, they're living in this absolutely insane time. And things like fluoridation in the water or what's going on with the COVID, they rely on that trust.
Yeah, they don't have time because people are time poor as well, having to earn all this money to pay the extra $1,000 a month on their mortgage.
Yeah, so those people rely on these. And there are three key pillars in this that just totally let Kiwis down. The public health fabric and our doctors and our medical system have completely let Kiwis down. The trust there is gone. And the second is the media. And that has, you know, been highlighted by this week again, the study released in terms of trust in the media and avoidance. Now, we talked about it earlier in the year that, you know, now 75, three quarters of people actively avoid the media.
Yeah.
Three quarters.
Yeah. In my lifetime, it's gone from something like 70% to 30% of people trusting the media.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I watched a really great interview with Michael Schellenberger that really summarizes this up and speaks to what happened to you as well. And he was talking about a censorship plan from the Department of Homeland Security, which he and his organization found, which came out of these color revolutions in rougher parts of the world. And he said that it was at another level. He said it was incredibly sophisticated and also incredibly brutal because it would talk about destroying people's reputations, destroying their characters, deplatforming them, debanking them. We have to draw a line in the sand and say, absolutely not. Parliament should not be passing this sort of legislation to give this small number of people this much control, given what's at stake, which is not just freedom of speech in any single country, but global control over all social media platforms. They're at serious risk of being controlled by governments by what you might call the deep state, these military intelligence agencies. If you lose free speech, you don't have democracy, you don't have freedoms. So that speaks to so much of what they were doing to you guys, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, saying that we're seeing this happen all over the world, it's worth reading this because it does speak, you know, this is the most relevant thing in the media, I thought. And he says Australia is one of the most urgent cases in the world in terms of what they're doing. They invent these Orwellian phrases to distract attention, anti-disinformation, anti-hate speech. And they're determined to get hold of X. He said that it's not a nice to have for them, it's a must have. They can't have that leak. It's a major flaw in their plan. He's talking also about the drive for total state control over society, over the culture and over the conversation. And he's saying now we have media literacy, which is teaching children to believe whatever the government and corporate media says. It's replacing critical thinking and it's brainwashing children. He's saying PSYOPs is an old-fashioned thing. What these guys are doing is so next level. They're working out how to program people before something becomes a story. And I've spoken about this in all the, most New Zealanders would prefer Kamala Harris. And I've said my suspicion is they're gearing, softening us up, not only to maintain faith in our own electoral process, but to get ready for the steal. Plan A was Joe Biden. Plan B was the first attempt to shoot Donald Trump. Plan C was Kamala. Plan D was the third attempt to shoot him. You know, Plan E or wherever we're up to is that sudden jump in the vote for someone who's deeply unpopular. We're just being gaslit. But he closes by saying, if your instinct is to silence people, I would say you have not evolved to where you need to be in the history of the Western Enlightenment. We humans have an irrational animal side and a rational human side. And it's that irrational side that says, I don't want to hear this. And that person must be silenced. And there's a tug of war between those two energies in us, in our civilization.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. There is. I hope the COVID inquiry will get to a bottom of a lot of these issues.
Well, he's pretty convincingly right, isn't he?
He is very convincingly right. And he's been one of the commentators too, who has been very, very good.
I was talking about Phil, but yeah.
Oh, sorry. Phil. But also, thank you. And but also looking at Schellenberger, you know, there are people out there like Schellenberger who, Barry Weiss is another, Mia Hughes on the gender issues.
So many great voices have emerged.
Incredible voices. Brett Weinstein, there's so many of them. And they have seen the shredding of the cohesion of the social fabric. And this is what allows us to live in a civilized society. And they have been tearing it apart. And in New Zealand, as you mentioned before about the Orwellian doublespeak, we had our purveyors, our brown-shirted messengers of doom for the New Zealand government in this country with the disinformation project this week. And I have to say that was the bright spot of my week. Seeing the disestablishment of that project, which to me is a blasphemous stain on this country, was...
Well, they've been replaced by a few other people who are keeping their hand. And, you know, something that's underreported is that Jacinda Ardern left her mission here on behalf of the World Economic Forum, and she's moved to the epicenter of the censorship project that I've just quoted Schellenberger is talking about, which is Harvard University. And they describe misinformation as an industry that's too big to fail. So she's putting the friendly mask on the totalitarian impulse that these technocrats have and is being sort of trundled around to reassure women, don't worry, and low-T men. But, you know, there's all of these little signs that pass without comment in the paper, jump in job seeker benefits in year, and it's saying people receiving the health condition or disability payment increased by 11,000 people or 14.3% compared to September 2023. And I bet that was up a fair bit on September 2022. The number of people receiving the health condition or disability payment increased by about 2,000 people or 2.3% in September compared to the previous month.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big deal. And I mean, you know, you talk to a lot of people. A lot of people are noticing they're just getting sick again and again and again.
Yeah. And those numbers, I mean, what are they now looking down the barrel of? $2 billion health blowout. It does make me laugh, though, how they jump on and they sort of, they're applying a lot of heat on the current coalition government about the state of our healthcare system. No, they're just, look, to be fair, it's been bad for a long time. You know, Lester Levy has got literally an impossible job. Richard Preble covered it in his opinion piece yesterday. It's an impossible job. It is literally trying to put fingers in the cracks of the dike that is about to burst. People are getting sicker. More people are leaving. What did Liam Dan, our mate Liam, say the other day? The year to date, 81,000 Kiwis have gone. Gone.
Yeah, and it's not a homogenous group of people going either.
No, it is not a homogenous group. TV1, I think, put a thing out on Facebook. I screenshotted and sent you, looking for doctors who are potentially going over to Australia. What does that fast track process look like? Are they leaving? Our closest friends, one set of our closest, dearest friends. I'm devastated by this, by the way. I'm so upset. Pleased for them. They're moving to Adelaide, and it breaks my heart. It absolutely breaks my heart because, you know, you want these people to stay. You want these people to be here to help all of us work together as a nation. When you've had, as I said before, when you've had someone like the mass formation that was led, well, spearheaded by Jacinda Ardern, shredding the cohesion of the social fabric of this country, what do you expect? I don't blame these people for going.
No, my instinct is to stay and not get driven out of my own country. And I've said before, I think a lot of the ethno-nationalism that we're seeing, if you look at it from a Kubono point of view, who does it benefit to have most of the New Zealanders who would resist us becoming a client state of China, for example, feeling disenfranchised from their nation? It's not that all of these interests within media and government are doing this because they feel bad for Māori. It's much the same as, you know, women thought the CIA and the Rockefellers were uplifting them, sponsoring feminism, but what they were sponsoring was division and demoralisation of the most likely opponents. I think we've got to maintain that cynicism. I think also, as the notices, you know, a lot of RCR listeners are, we've got to understand that people aren't experiencing this inertia for want of good information often. Although it's important, as Mateus Desmet says, we've got to keep speaking out. And this is a good opportunity to ask our listeners, please just share.
Mm-hmm.
If you find yourself talking to someone about something you've heard on RCR, share the interview with them. They might scoff at it. Just share it. And we've got to get more people listening to it, because there are so many people who are willing to express an opinion on RCR who have never listened to it. My feeling is it sells itself. Like, I listen to The Breakfast Show, especially, as I often say, and listen to so many other shows, and I think this is just so great.
Mm. I can't tell you about how many times in recent months that I've either been on a plane or a bus or a taxi or wherever I've been, you know, and you that general chit-chat that you have. And if, especially if you're chatting to somebody long enough and you get to the what do you do question, which in my case is very complicated. However,
yeah, mine too.
Yours too, exactly. Well, I sometimes clean carpets and I sometimes do this, you know. Yeah.
Like a bit of olive oil, right? Like a bit of olive oil, marketing, look after kids.
Yeah, exactly. But you can get a vibe. You can get a vibe off somebody that things are a little weird, and that they, and weird in the sense that they're not fully engrossed in the mass, right? And if they're not fully engrossed in the mass, and there are still people out there that are their boots and all, they still think that Dear Leader has been the greatest thing that ever happened to this country and will be celebrating. I mean, who's doing the investiture in London next week? I mean,
Prince William,
yeah, exactly. So, you know, they will think that that's one of the greatest days in New Zealand history, which to me is an absolute stain on the whole. Mm. But anyway, moving on. And when I talk about this is who we are, this is who we work with, this is what we talk about, and I say to them, look, we are having those conversations out loud that you guys only whisper around at smoko time or on a job site or, you know, quietly in the pub, careful, you know, worried that someone might overhear. We are actually having those conversations out loud.
Yeah,
not crazy.
The emperor wears no clothes.
Yeah. Yeah, as Marty said, you know, do share. There is so much share. We're getting more shareables up too, smaller little clips that you can share out there. But there are so many brilliant interviews that we've done, some key people that we'll talk to. I mean, I spoke to Helen Joyce yesterday. I mean, she is in the one of the clearest, most articulate voices in the whole ridiculousness of the trans debate. She is amazing. And that was one of the things that Mateus Desmet said in his book of The Psychology of Totalitarianism. The way to break this is the tap, 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 tap. And now that the disinformation project is no longer around to tell those, to reinforce with those in the mass that, you know, we're evil. I mean, the ridiculousness. One of the things, actually, again, in this book, if you've not read it, and I know I harp on about it all the time, but in the book, he talks about how people will be so hypnotized in believing of what's going on, they will do the most monstrous things. And he talks about an Iranian woman who literally sent her son up to be prosecuted for going against the regime and then in turn being beheaded and being so, but he didn't follow the rules, you know, using that as an example. We see the same here. We see the same here with the Disinformation Project. They say the most ridiculous things. Who can forget Kate Hanna talking about the new wave of white supremacy and terrorism, domestic terrorism in New Zealand, is in the format of women who might happen to like cooking and love children or on Instagram.
Braid their hair.
Now, to a normal person, that is freaking bonkers. But when you're in the mass, oh, yes.
Mm.
That's how you know you're hypnotized. If you didn't think that was bonkers at the time, you were under the spell. If you're thinking it's sounding a bit bonkers now, welcome to the club.
Well, we're sort of, I mean, probably there's a lot of stuff we haven't talked about. I looked for any newspaper reference to the emerging allegations that Tim Walz was having sex with his 14-year-old male students. Nothing in there. Maybe it's still in the, maybe it's in the malinformation.
But where Hunter's laptop went. Is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's they're doing some preemptive programming. Who knows?
And we need to strap in 3 weeks out. We're going to have to strap in because it is only going to get more insane, I think, with how things start ramping up, particularly over there. And again, here, you know, I mean, honestly, that tile run the other day, David Seymour, good on him. He got really annoyed because they did the tile run. And if you don't know what the tile run, I got to see it in person, actually, when I was in Parliament the other month. There's a set of tiles which runs between the offices where the parliamentarians all sit through the chamber. And
good Masonic black and white.
Yeah, yes. And it's this little space where the media are allowed to congregate and then essentially interview the politicians as they go from point A to point B. In the tile run, the questions being asked, nothing about the Solicitor General's new guidelines in terms of saying to prosecutors that you need to consider the race of the perpetrator when it comes to prosecuting cases. Really? What? Gah! No. They're more concerned about the Tui billboards and what Christopher Luxon is selling another property. Really? Is this what we've come to?
Yeah.
Good on Seymour for calling out.
Yeah, it's going to be a crazy few weeks, but we're here to join you in shaking our collective heads about it.
We are here to join you in shaking our collective heads. And to that end, there have been a few clips. We apologise greatly for not getting to feedback last week. It was a funny old week last week because we were in that weird old space where we were sort of a little bit fractious and crabby and lots of things were going on. But we do appreciate your feedback. 2057 is the text number. Inbox at realitycheck.radio. And we're seeing a lot more engagement too. As we said, there's a lot more of those shorts going on out, yeah. Especially on X. If you're wanting to see lots of really neat little snippets or shareables, go across to X and check those out. For Media Matters, Richard says, why is the mainstream New Zealand media still full of lies and political propaganda years after the fall of Labour? Well, Richard, that is the question of the day, is it not? TVNZ is about to collapse financially, yet they continue to push their left-wing agenda morning and night until they fire the seated Labour appointees. The public will continue to hate on them, and rightfully so, yet they can't see it, which means the whole company must be rotten to the core. Actually, Richard, I think Richard's brought up a really good point there, Marty, is, again, talking to what we were talking about with Phil's case, is one of the things I've discovered, and I've done an interview that's also going to talk to this in the coming weeks, one of the things that I've discovered is there are people within the machinery of the public service who hold the most incredible amount of power over our lives. And those people are perennial. A change in government is irrelevant to them. This is terrifying.
The swamp. Yeah, whoever you vote for, government still wins. We actually did get a listener wrote in and took exception to a joke I made the Media Matters before last, where I described feminism as a union for unattractive women. And she said it was Angela. I'd like to apologise to Angela, but I went back over the clip and I actually couldn't find anything to apologise for. I think it is correct. And I didn't mean unattractive as in ugly, because there are plenty of women who are conventionally, you might call ugly, who are beautiful. I just mean, you know, they're not that likeable, and so they do things like lobby to get themselves on boards when maybe their competence isn't up to snuff on the basis of their sex. That's what I meant, Angela. And I think, was there another remark I made that I did say that the first casualty of feminism was humour? And I think there's a pretty good argument made for that too.
Yeah.
Thanks for writing in, Angela. You know, I appreciate your point of view. We're not, I'm not crapping on you or anything.
But you're right.
It's a miracle we got this far without a complaint like that, actually.
Well, no, but ugliness isn't always physical.
Yeah. Good.
And we have seen that, haven't we? Have we not seen that in the last 4 to 5 years? Ugliness isn't always physical. It is emotional. It is spiritual. It is so many things.
And beauty comes from unexpected places as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other clip actually that has had a lot of engagement was we were talking about the birth rate. And again, this goes into all the stuff that we've been talking about. Absolute plummeting birth rate in this country. Mm. They clipped out, we were looking at the birth rate in Wellington suburbs. So those in the most affluent suburbs weren't having children, whereas those in the least affluent were. And then we got a lot of engagement on that. Mark said, you could say the rich are dying out because they aren't having kids. Charmaine, she had a quote from Genesis, be fruitful and multiply, believe God and obey him, and don't yearn for idols. Oh, I have to, indeed. Steve Tate said it's because this is what the government is paying for. And yeah, that's, you know, we've talked about that before, the government paying for you to abrogate your responsibility as a parent and allow them to pick up that responsibility as the state, whether that be through state-funded childcare or, I don't know, tax breaks, what have you. You know, it's, as you said, what did you call it before, that grooming, isn't it?
Mm,
yeah. Is it grooming? Is it social engineering? Or is it a supportive hand up? Potato, potato.
Well, I normally talk about Michael Baker as being the Woody Allen of public health, starting this grooming again. But, you know, people often say to me, oh, you know, I talk to young people about having kids and they say, oh, the world's just such a mess. I don't, you know that it's right to have kids. And I always say, are you planning on having kids that make more mess or clean it up? I said, well, you know, I clean it up, well, you better have some.
Yeah.
I see China's, there was an article saying China's Chinese officials are now heavying people out to have kids.
Is that a 180?
Well, it's, you know, demographics take a long time to turn around. If you think about, you know, each child in China has had four grandparents and has been the sole focus of their affections. If that isn't a recipe for people who don't do well being married or having kids themselves, you know, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm.
Because having kids, you just have to get used to being dead last, but a fair bit.
It's the little things, yeah. You have to be the one that goes to bed last for years. You never eat a meal that's ever warm.
Well, you eat a lot of leftovers. As a man, it's quite a strong instinct I've got to eat my kids' leftovers.
There's so many things that we can talk about. One of the things that we didn't touch on, and I know that we will, in terms of health, that we will touch on, I'm sure, in coming episodes, is also to the wider focus now on where health is. Did you see there was an opinion piece around the cutting of services for specific and Māori health? Nowhere ever, yeah, ever does it talk about the general lifestyle and well-being of those people.
Turning up for medical appointments.
Yeah, but also to diet. You know, I mean, I'm the New Zealand president of the Katie Hopkins Chumbawamba Club. I am the first to admit I'm a hefty gal. However, I've worked really, really hard to also make sure that I try and have a good diet. My children have a good diet, you know, so as the minimal amounts of processed foods, try and eat fresh, making your own meals if you can manage it, you know, simple things like that. And they talk about the poverty trap and that those who are in that space can only afford crap. Well, I call bullshit on that. I know plenty of people who are in very, very tight financial situations. They'll tell you it's actually easier and cheaper to eat healthy if you're resourceful and you know what you're doing, what it is to eat absolute processed crap. Yeah, so I'm sure that we will talk about that theme definitely more over the coming weeks. And I also want to thank you, my friend, steadfast support. You've been on this journey with us right from the beginning. You've, you know, I can't tell you how many phone calls and text messages you've had both from Mr. Marie and I over this time.
Yeah, no, well,
we appreciate it.
Thank you for saying so, Marie, but it's been a privilege and an honour to be along on the ride. And, you know, I hope things pan out well this week. And as I said, you're both on the right side of history. We are. And it's in the short term harder to do the right thing sometimes. But in the long term, it's better.
Yeah, absolutely. couldn't agree more. If you've got any questions or comments that you want to make, 2057 is the text inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email. And as I said, there will be a longer format interview coming out with Alistair in the coming weeks. We just need to wait to get that judgment locked and loaded before there's no point sort of doing it until we know what the final outcome is. And I want to thank you everyone again for tuning in. And as we can't reiterate this enough. Share. Costs you nothing.
Yeah. And to the people who are Foundation members, thanks again. We can't thank you enough. And speaking of Alistair Harding, he's doing some great work and it's made possible by you. And that's work that will help everyone in this country.
Yeah. And his work, particularly on the CBDCs, is actually a really good starting point. If you've got somebody who is in that COVID mass and do not want to go there whatsoever, the whiff of the word vaccine sends them running for the hills, have a look at Alistair's work on the CBDCs. No problems there. I think that's a really good safe place, a really good soft landing spot for those people, for sure.
Soft and then terrifying. All right, thanks, Marie.
Hey, thanks, Marty, and we'll do it all again next week here with Media Matters. Of course, 1 o'clock here on a Thursday with Reality Check Radio.
Have a great week.